Thanks, everybody, again. My name is Rick Kegman from EPA. When you were saying heroes, I thought you were going to talk about EPA, but then I knew better. Because those two terms usually don't go together, unfortunately. But it is a pleasure to be here, and I had really hoped that last year's disagreements in Washington would have worked themselves out in time for me to get here, but didn't. But I'm glad that I had the opportunity to come back this year. So I am going to talk about kind of the re-registration process and the public involvement opportunities, but in the course of my talk, I also wanted to give you some updates on some things that are going on at EPA that I think you all will be interested in hearing about, and or at least one of these items. There's an active public comment period right now, so if this is an issue that impacts you specifically, it would be good to hear from you. The first thing that I'm just going to briefly touch on is the pipeline on the registration side, and we had a rather productive year in the pesticide program at EPA when you think that we basically had 10.5 months in our fiscal year because of the time that we were away. We registered 14 new active ingredients, and that's not all of them are necessarily for use in cotton, but it shows that there's a vibrant pipeline of new products coming forward and over 200 new uses to support pest management needs around the country. I think perhaps the most important one for you all in this was the return of sulfoxaflor. You all probably are aware that this was a product that then Dow AgroSciences had registered with us, and then the registration was vacated by the courts. So last summer we did renew the approvals for sulfoxaflor on a large number of crops. This is probably one of the few active ingredients where we have a tremendous amount of pollinator data, and that was really the main issue that was seen by the courts as why they found the original registration to be problematic from their standpoint. So working with Dow and now Corteva, we were able to develop some additional data and redo our risk-benefit analysis for a multitude of crops, including cotton. And there are some additional uses in the pipeline that will likely come on board in 2020. So how many of you are familiar with registration review? Maybe show your hands. How many of you are familiar with the term re-registration? A few more. So this is, registration review is re-registration part two. So we finished re-registration in 2008. And then what Congress said is, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't just be looking at chemicals one time and be done, because we know that science evolves, information changes, new things become available. So when they passed the Food Quality Protection Act amendments in the late 90s, and then through some changes in legislation subsequently, they created what's called the Registration Review Program. And so what it is rather than a one-time re-registration process, what it is instead is it's a process that every 15 years, we reevaluate every active ingredient. And so we're currently in that, what we call that first round or first cycle of registration review. So there are about 1,100 active ingredients that we've grouped into about 725 cases that we are actively reviewing. The statutory deadline for completing that review is October 1st of 2022. So we have a little bit less than 3 years to complete the process. And so here's, from a general overview standpoint, what I think is very important for you all, and here's where I'll spend a good bit of time, talking about where we can hear from you and what's important. So this chart that you see up here, this graphic that you see up here, this is about a 6 to 7 year process. And it's designed that way purposefully so that we are thoughtful in our assessment and that we give multiple opportunities for stakeholders to provide input into the work that we do. So what it starts with is what we call a preliminary work plan. Basically what we do is we scope out what we think we know about the active ingredient, what its registered uses are, how it's used, and what additional data we think we're going to need, primarily from the registrants, to conduct that reevaluation. And then we put that plan out for public comment and we take a pause. So there's an opportunity for the public for about 60 days to review that work plan, and then based upon the feedback that we receive, we issue a final work plan. And then that first green arrow that you see there, that then becomes about a 2 to 3 year process where the registrants are developing the additional data that we've said that we needed to support the reevaluation, and we're conducting the risk assessments. And then at that point, we issue the draft risk assessments for public comment, and we take a pause. So there's about another 60-day public comment period. We seek your all's input. And I'll come back to the slide and that piece of the process in a second. And then we evaluate those comments. We revise the risk assessments if we think it's warranted. And then we come up with a proposed interim decision or a proposed regulatory decision. And this is where we're doing our cost-benefit analysis. And we take a pause so that we can consider the feedback that's come in from stakeholders, and then we revise that proposal based upon the feedback that we've received, and then we issue an interim or a final decision, which then kicks up off a process, again, back to working with the registrants to revise the labels to reflect that decision. So hopefully this arrow will work. So we're largely in these two phases right now. The bulk of the chemicals are either in the draft risk assessment stage or in the proposed decision phase. And these are the two areas where getting your all's input is vital. But what you provide and when is really important. So at the draft risk assessment stage, what we really want to hear from you all is, how are you using it? Did we assess the use rates correctly? Did we assess how many applications in a season you're using it correctly? Finding out here how valuable it is, good to know. How valuable it is doesn't change the risk assessment. So what we're really looking for is how you use it, and if we've overestimated, how we've overestimated, and to the extent to which you can point to extension publications or information from your land-grant university, something tangible that can support what you're saying, then we can modify the risk assessment to reflect how you all are actually using it. And if it means that in a certain part of cotton production it's used a certain way, and then in a different part of cotton production it's used a different way, that's good to highlight too, because then we can kind of bracket the assessment that way. But here's, at that draft risk assessment stage, that's really where the science part is done on both the human health and the ecological effect side. So if you're writing in at this stage and saying, this is really important to us, don't cancel it, we want to hear you. But that's not going to change how we did the assessment. What will influence how we do the assessment is if you have better data than we do on how it's been used, or the differential use pattern across cotton production areas, that can lead us to changing the risk assessment. Now, its importance to you all is vitally important at this proposed decision phase. And so, again, I don't want to discourage you from saying that at the draft risk assessment stage, but it really won't have much of a change in how we do the assessment. The proposed decision phase, when we're looking at benefits and we're weighing benefits and risks, so hearing from people about how vital it is helpful. What's more helpful is if you can tell us, if I didn't have this compound, this is what the impacts on my yield would be. for, this is what my cost of production would be because I'd have to use 2, 3, whatever other products, and the cost to me is X amount higher than by using this one. So kind of at this stage, showing us kind of, not because we're considering canceling, but because what we're trying to figure out is what's the value. And so tools in the toolbox, we get that, and that's important for you all to get across to us, please tell us that. But to the extent to which you can quantify economically or biologically what the effects on pest management would be, or what the effects on your farm budget would be, and again, to the extent to which you can be citing to extension publications or even Economic Research Service information from USDA, really important here, because we, even though we often will work with and consult with USDA before we get to this stage, you all are the ones using the product, and so we want to hear from you. And then the last thing I just say here is it's not a vote, so if we get, you know, neonicotinoids as an example, we got 1 million comments on our risk assessment. The vast majority of them told us to ban the neonicotinoids. So we wanted to hear from folks, but just because the vast majority said you should ban the neonicotinoids doesn't necessarily mean we're going to ban the neonicotinoids, because we're running a science-driven process. And so the more you can be providing us with science at the risk assessment stage and science at the proposed decision stage, the more concrete information that we can point to when people maybe don't like our decision, that we can say, here are some independent pieces of data that helped to inform our decision, and it wasn't just solely based upon how people feel about something. So that's really my message to you all, is we really want to hear from you all. And if all you have is how important this is to me, I don't want to discourage you from engaging with us. But as you're pulling together those comments, the more information you can provide us on, like I said, primarily how you're using it or what the value or the impacts on your operations would be, the more helpful that is ultimately in our decision-making process. So we do a lot of these in the course of any year, and that number is going to keep going up as we work towards 2022. We put out 85 risk assessments for public comment this past year, and then about 75 proposed decisions, then about 80 ultimate decisions. So, and we're putting these out typically about 4 times a year. We do have a schedule posted on our website that shows when we estimate these will come out for their different public comment periods. We know sometimes these public comment periods fall at a very inopportune time for you all to engage with us, and so that's in part why we have published the schedules at about a year in advance to give people a heads up on what may be coming out for public engagement in the coming year. For this year, again, we're looking at basically the same number of assessments, but we're starting to get into some of the harder chemicals from a risk assessment standpoint. Among those, the neonicotinoids, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a slide or two. Our proposed decision will be coming out later this year. And then we've already started to issue some risk assessments and proposed decisions on the pyrethroids, and more of those will be coming out in FY, or in calendar year 20 as well. So a few updates on some of the chemicals that have already been through the risk assessment stage and are getting to a decision-making stage. So the organophosphates have gotten a lot of attention. Almost all of the risk assessments for the organophosphates have already been issued for public comment over the last couple of years. We have a couple more to go. We haven't issued as many of proposed decisions or final decisions on those at this point, because there's some important information that's being generated by the registrants right now to help us better understand, particularly more on the human health side. We're trying to reconcile some of the data in the public literature versus animal laboratory data. I know one that's particularly important to you all is acephate, and so Don Parker's come in a couple of times to meet with us and stress with us the importance of acephate to your all's operation. This one is a particular challenge for us as we go through this process. We've already issued the risk assessments for public comment. This is one where, and we don't see this often with the organophosphates, but where for food exposures alone, we have a risk issue. Oftentimes it's, we hear about, well, it's EPA and their water model, and their water model's wrong. We're working to fix that, by the way. But oftentimes it's water that's driving some of the concerns. In this one with acephate, it's food that's driving the concerns, and we can't consider benefits by law when we're considering food-driven human health risks. So better understanding how it's used, when it's used, what the residues might be, is critically important as we continue to move through that. And I know some information is being generated here that will hopefully help to refine this assessment. Chlorpyrifos, which I'm not sure is as important to you all, but I think some of you likely use it. Many of you are probably aware that EPA has been sued a couple of times over chlorpyrifos. I'm not going to read this slide because it's really busy, but the long and short of it is last summer, after a decade-long process, we denied a petition, and then there's basically an appeal of the petition called an objections phase. So we actually denied the objections to our denial of the petition, which has now triggered another round of litigation. What we announced when we denied the petition to revoke the tolerances and cancel the registrations was that we were accelerating the review of chlorpyrifos, and we are anticipating this summer issuing updated human health and drinking water risk assessments for public comment, and then we will, by October of this year, issue a proposed decision for public comment. So there is a lot happening on chlorpyrifos. Just earlier this fall, I alluded to some work that we're trying to do to refine how we consider drinking water in our assessment and how we estimate drinking water exposures or pesticide exposures through drinking water. We just engaged with an outside independent peer review group called the Scientific Advisory Panel to give us some input on how to better refine our drinking water models, and so we'll be incorporating their feedback into this assessment that we'll put out this summer. Glyphosate, I know, is critically important to you all. We issued last year our proposed decision for public comment. We essentially found no risks of public health concern for glyphosate, and like most other regulatory bodies around the world, we concluded that glyphosate is not a carcinogen. We received about 500,000 comments on that proposed decision. And you can imagine what some of those might have been like, given what you, I don't know if where you all live, you have certain types of advertisements on TV from lawyers. We certainly do in DC, so you can imagine the types of comments that we got. So that final decision will be coming out very early this calendar year. I mentioned the neonicotinoids. This has been a very challenging set of assessments. We conducted these assessments jointly with both Canada and with the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. This is one where we've done a series of both human health and ecological risk assessments, including pollinator risk assessments. And we did identify some risks of concern in certain areas. We've been working with stakeholders and with the registrants to identify some possible mitigation strategies for the neonicotinoids, and we, again, are expecting to issue a proposed decision for public comment on these four neonicotinoids and also acetamiprid, again, early this calendar year. The pyrethroids are also at that proposed decision phase. There's been a lot of work to refine the human health risk assessment, working with the pesticide registrants. We issued a proposed risk mitigation strategy to deal with aquatic invertebrate risks back in November, and that public comment period ends this coming Monday. So I suspect you all will engage in this one, and we're looking forward to receiving your comments. On the biotechnology side, I think you all are aware that Secretary Perdue recently declared that pink bollworm had been eradicated. And so in response to that declaration by the Secretary, the BT registrants have submitted amendments to EPA to make changes to the registrations as in regards to the refuse requirement. All of the registrants have now submitted requests to amend their labels to address that refuge issue. And I think the first due date for one of those is early February. We're anticipating that we'll make decisions on all of them at the same time, just so that there's a level playing field across all of the BT cotton products. And then, I don't know how I'm doing on time.
You're good, you got
okay.
It.
So, I don't have slides in here about Enlist cotton because, of the cotton traits, the one that's been taking up most of my time is the Extend trait. But let me briefly say that I think you all are probably aware that the Enlist trait from the EPA side is operating under a 5-year registration. That registration will lapse in 2022, I believe. And then before 2022, we'll need to do another assessment to see if we can continue the registration for Enlist Solo and Enlist Duo. Dicamba's had a slightly more challenging path. We initially issued 2-year registrations to 3 products. The Syngenta representative alluded to Tavium's availability this past year, so now there are 4 formulations that are registered for use with Extend soybeans and cotton. We've gone through a series of label changes in response to incidents that we received. The 2017 season was a bit challenging with the number of incidents that came to EPA's attention. And so we made a number of changes to the registrations after only 1 year to look at what we could do to potentially reduce those incidents from occurring. And so among those, we made the products restricted use, we required training, we put in place some instructions to address tank cleanout. We tried to look at what the incidents were and what was maybe causing those incidents to make changes, again, based upon science, to help to reduce the potential for those incidents from occurring. And so 2018, these changes that you see up on this slide were the new requirements that were put in place. And what we still saw incidents, although not as many, and Dicamba had initially only had a 2-year registration. So at the end of 2019, we needed to do another look at the, or 2018, I should say. We had to do another look at the registration, and so we renewed it for an additional 2 years, but we put in place additional requirements. So among those now, you're probably aware, only certified applicators can apply the products. Previously, they could be applied under the supervision of a certified applicator. And then there were certain planting restrictions or use restrictions put on when the technology could be applied to the plants. So in cotton, it was 60 days after planting was the last time that the products could be used. And then in cotton, we reduced the number of times it could be used from 4 applications over the top to 2 applications over the top. And then probably most significantly is we put in place some additional buffers to deal with volatility drift, and including putting in place at county levels in certain parts of the country county-specific limitations and requirements. As I mentioned, so we will be looking at that registration again at the end of this calendar year. They expire, all 4 registrations expire in December of this year. The registrants have been working to develop a number of field studies to help us better examine the potential for off-site movement of dicamba, and those studies are now being evaluated. They conducted studies in Illinois, Missouri, and Mississippi to try to get at, to see if geography played a role in some of these off-target movements. And so those, some of the studies are already in. We expect the remainder of the studies to be submitted to us by the end of this month. In some states have put in place state-specific requirements. So you need to do what your state is telling you to do as it relates to beyond the federal label. Some states have been put in place cutoff dates. Other states have put in place specific training programs that you need to have completed in order to use the technology. So consult with your state to see if there are additional requirements when you're using the dicamba technology. I'm just going to, for interest of time, I'm going to skip over that. And then, so what are we going to be doing this year? We're gathering information from all of the incidents that have occurred. We've got a slew of data that will be coming in. And then we're anticipating lots of engagement with states and academics over the course of the next year to understand data that they have been developing and working towards a regulatory decision in time for people to be making seed purchase decisions for the 2021 planting season. And then real briefly, I just wanted to update you on 2 of our worker rules. Back in 2015, we had updated the worker protection standard, which affects or puts in place requirements for people that apply pesticides and are involved in the use of pesticides in agriculture. Back in November, we proposed a change to something called the application exclusion zone, which is essentially a buffer around the application equipment. That public comment period closes at the end of this month, and we are looking forward to hearing from you all about any concerns you have with that proposal. The idea here was to loosen the requirements. And then finally, for those of you that are certified pesticide applicators, back in 2017, we revised the certification requirements for pesticide applicators. States have been working with us and perhaps with many of you all to develop modifications to those plans. What's really important is that states submit their draft plans to us by March 4th of this year. If they submit their plans by March 4th, then their existing plan remains in place until EPA approves it. And then the process would be we would complete our reviews in about 2 years, and then we would establish a timeline for when those plans need to go into effect. And I know I ran long, so I apologize. All right. I did start early, and I told you I'd still take up time.
Right.
All right. So I'm going to stop there.
Great. Great job. You covered everything. We got time for maybe a couple of quick questions. Keith?
Could you say a word about the new Paraquat
this year?
Hey, Keith, let Don.
If you will, restate with the mic so that everybody hears.
Yeah, if you could just give us a quick update on the new Paraquat certification requirements and labeling starting here in 2020 for new production? Thanks.
Right. So, you know, for a number of years we've been evaluating paraquat. You know, there have been some unfortunate incidents involving paraquat where people have died, not from necessarily the legal use, but from illegal use of decanting, and then sometimes people using it for suicides, but sometimes people accidentally ingesting it, thinking that it was something else. So for a number of years, we worked with the registrants to revise the labels. We made paraquat restricted use, and again, I think it's for this year, only certified applicators can apply it. It won't be for under the supervision, because we really want to focus in on those people that have been specifically trained in how to use it. And then there is a paraquat-specific training program that the label requires people to have completed before they use the product. Later on, there are some product container modifications that we're still working with the registrants on, again, to try to prevent this decanting from happening so that we don't have these unfortunate incidents of people either using it to try to kill themselves or for people accidentally ingesting it because they think that it's something else.
Anybody else? Rick, I certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.